Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the NHS Estates podcast, where we discuss the latest guidance and the best practice for managing land and property transactions in the NHS. I'm your host, Stan Campbell, a partner in our health property team, and I'm joined today by my co-host, George Taylor, one of our property litigators. So today we're talking about the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954, which is relevant to NHS trusts, both as landlord and as tenant. George, could you give me a brief overview of the 1954 Act and its relevance to the NHS, please?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Dan. So the 1954 Act, first place to start, it's a very important piece of legislation and it's potentially applicable to all business leases that a trust enters into. So the standard position, what we often see, is that leases are excluded from the 1954 Act. And if that is the case, a tenant must vacate the premises at the end of the term. They don't have any right to remain in occupation. However, contrast that where a commercial lease isn't contracted out of the 1954 Act, a tenant who occupies for business purposes will have security of tenure. And what that means is it's the right to remain in occupation after the contractual term of a lease expires. And it also gives the tenant an entitlement to a new lease unless the landlord can oppose renewal on one or more specified grounds under the Act. Now, for the purposes of this talk, I don't intend to go into those grounds in any detail. They are very specific, and it could be the subject of a talk in itself. But the landlord will have to provide sufficient evidence to satisfy the relevant ground, and statutory compensation may be payable.
Excellent. That's really helpful. Thank you, George. So in a protected lease situation, what is the process for either renewing a lease or terminating it?
So let's start with renewals. They tend to be the easier process. Now that's commenced by either the tenant serving a Section 26 request or the landlord serving a Section 25 notice, which sets out proposed renewal terms. So it's important to note that the terms set out in the request or the notice, they aren't binding and they're for negotiation purposes only. So the notice needs to give between 6 and 12 months notice of the date that the tenant intends for the new lease to commence or the date that the landlord wishes the current lease to come to an end, with a new lease being put in place afterwards. The date specified, and this is important, it can't be earlier than the contractual expiry date of the lease. And then to move on to termination, that process is begun by a landlord serving what we call a hostile Section 25 notice, i.e. that's one that doesn't contain proposed renewal terms, and it has to confirm the grounds on which the landlord intends to oppose renewal. The landlord can also serve a counter notice to a tenant's Section 26 request, but it has to do that within 2 months of receipt of the Section 26 request.
Okay. So if the parties are agreed that a renewal lease is to be put in place, is it the case that terms are often agreed without much dispute?
Well, you'd hope so, but no, sadly not. There are often disputes, even where the parties agree in principle that a lease renewal is to be granted.
And this is where you come in as a property litigator, isn't it? So when disputes arise and how are they resolved?
So the basic lease renewal position is that the current lease arrangement should continue. So any attempt to deviate from that has the potential to cause dispute. It's most likely to be on matters such as repair, particularly as you might now be dealing with a building which is ageing and perhaps not as fit for purpose as it was when the current lease was granted. That can also extend into any service charge provisions and whether those remain fit for purpose in the modern property market that we now operate in. In the absence of agreement, it's usually necessary to issue court proceedings to put a timetable in place, which ultimately ends up at trial. And at that trial, a judge will decide on which terms should be included in a renewal lease. The court's general approach to determining lease terms was set out in a 1983 case. A few guidelines were set down by the court. The starting point is always the terms of the current tenancy. The burden of persuading a court to change the terms of the current tenancy sits with the party who is proposing the change, And then finally, that change in terms must be fair and reasonable in all of the circumstances.
So what are the most common disputed terms? And can you provide some examples of the court's recent determinations on these?
Yes, sure. So probably predictably, rent is or tends to be the most commonly disputed term, given how important it is. If the parties can't agree the rent, the court will decide this using the valuation formula set out in the Act. The court doesn't have any discretion in terms of rent. It's purely a matter of valuation. So it's ultimately one for expert evidence if agreement can't be reached. That valuation formula is the sum at which the property might reasonably be expected to be let in the open market by a willing landlord, having regard to the terms of the new tenancy and disregarding specified matters.
Excellent, thank you. What about where the landlord wants to redevelop but does not have concrete plans in place? Is there any scope to add a break to allow them to terminate the new lease for development purposes further down the line?
Yes, so this is something that we've seen quite regularly in the not too distant past. We've seen a number of landlords seeking to include redevelopment break clauses in 1954 Act protected renewal leases. So generally, the courts have made it clear on a number of occasions that it's not the Act's policy for the tenant's rights to inhibit reconstruction and redevelopment of property. If a landlord can persuade the court that there's a real possibility that redevelopment will take place during the term of the new lease, the general position is that the court is likely to include a redevelopment break clause. The landlord doesn't have to show that its intended redevelopment is imminent, although its case is likely to be much stronger if it can make that point to the court. So the court's aim is to strike a fair balance between allowing the landlord to use and redevelop its premises whilst also giving the tenant a reasonable amount of security of tenure. So there's a relatively recent case. It's the B&M retail case, which addressed the question of whether the inclusion of a redevelopment break clause in a renewal lease can be justified, and if so, how far into the term of that new lease should the break be exercisable? So the issue here arose as a result of an administrative issue. The landlord failed to serve a counter notice opposing renewal in response to a Section 26 request that B&M served. As I mentioned earlier on, that needed to be done within 2 months of service of the Section 26 request, and it wasn't. As a result, the tenant was automatically entitled to a renewal lease. The tenant proposed a 10-year term, and the landlord, quite different, an 18-month term with the landlord's redevelopment break clause exercisable on not less than 6 months' notice. Predictably, terms weren't agreed, and the matter proceeded to court. Now, what the court was looking at and what the case hinged on was whether there was a real possibility that the landlord would be successful in obtaining planning permission in respect of its proposed development. The court's view was that on the evidence, and there was a lot of evidence produced by the landlord, that the landlord could show this. So the court accepted, it wasn't ignorant of the fact that the consequences of a break clause would act harshly on the tenant, who would inevitably suffer some loss as a result of the decision. But they did say that this wasn't an overriding consideration. The court's conclusion was that it was therefore appropriate to include a landlord's redevelopment break clause. And the court held that the break should be immediately operable on 6 months' notice to give the landlord every chance to achieve its redevelopment aims. So the landlord effectively did as well as it possibly could. It would always have had to give at least 6 months' notice. So a good result for the landlord there.
Absolutely. So that's quite generic 1954 Act stuff. Let's turn to the NHS context. And pursuant to the Health and Care Act 2022, the NHS became the first health system to embed net zero into its legislation. With that and the NHS Green Lease Framework in mind, have the courts been reluctant to impose green lease provisions in a renewal lease?
Yeah, so as a general point, there isn't yet a great deal of case law in relation to green lease clauses. It's, as you know, quite an emerging topic. So it hasn't really run through the court system as yet, but I think it's inevitable that that's going to change in the near future. what we do have some case law specifically in terms of minimum energy efficiency standards. There's a relatively recent case which gives an example of the court's approach. So in that case, the landlord sought to make the tenant liable to comply with the minimum energy efficiency standards through a proposed of new terms on the renewal of a lease granted in 2010, so prior to those standards being put in place. The judge rejected most of the terms, but was persuaded to include a clause which obliged the tenant to return the premises to the landlord with the same EPC rating as it had at the date of the new lease. And the judge considered that the inclusion of that new term could be justified on the grounds of essential fairness and that it was a fair and reasonable change. In general, any attempt to introduce new clauses requiring the tenant to deliver up the premises in a way that complies with MEES is likely to be met with some resistance. So the tenant will probably say that the new clauses unreasonably shift the burden of compliance from landlords to tenants, whereas on the other hand, landlords will argue reasonable modernisation, as MEES introduces an entirely new burden that wasn't contemplated by the parties when they entered into the original lease. And it will be interesting to see how that plays out in court in the future.
Mm, indeed. So, George, we've had estate code or health building note 0008 with us for some 10 years now. What does that say about the 1954 Act?
Well, it very much depends on whether the trust is landlord or tenant from our experience. If landlord, then estate code is clear that trusts should maintain flexibility of their estates and only grant leases which are excluded from the 1954 Act. So ultimately, the tenant won't have the right to a new lease at the end of the term. And as trusts, as a general rule, shouldn't grant protected leases, I suggest it's also implied that trusts should take all necessary steps to prevent tenants from acquiring 1954 Act protection through informal occupation or inaction on expiry of their lease, which is something that we do see from time to time where a lease which is excluded from the 1954 Act comes to an end and the tenant remains in occupation for quite a considerable period of time afterwards. So it's important to ensure, from our experience, that where a trust has a tenant coming to the end of a 1954 Act excluded lease, that steps should be taken to either recover possession at the end of the term or make sure that a new arrangement is entered into, which basically sets out the terms on which the tenant is going to continue to occupy. Now, on the other hand, where the trust is a tenant, particularly when capital is being spent on the property or if the term is particularly long, then seeking protection of the 1954 Act is generally recommended.
Excellent, thank you. And, you know, maybe this is an unfair question, but can estate code trump the 1954 Act?
Well, it's a question which often comes up, usually in terms of the length of term of a renewal lease and or a term certain where the trust is a tenant. So, for instance, estate code provides that NHS organisations should seek to agree break clauses giving flexibility of occupation and that leases of over 5 years should be avoided unless appropriate break clauses are included. So it's fairly clear on that point. Now, while some landlords might be prepared to agree a break clause to take effect at year five, it's not guaranteed that they'll do so. And we have seen some landlords push back on this before. In those circumstances, whilst reference to estate code might assist in negotiations, the court has discretion as to whether to order the inclusion of a break clause. They aren't bound to grant a tenant break simply because estate code provides for this. It is something that they will probably take into account, but they've also got the landlord's arguments as well. So it's not a given that that will be included. The court's going to look at all of the circumstances, in particular the length of term of the new tenancy, any break rights in the current tenancy, and also the trust's specific reasons for acquiring a break clause. Now, there aren't any binding authorities on the point at the moment, which would be helpful. But there are some first instance decisions which suggest that a tenant needs to show that there is a real possibility that it won't need the premises beyond a certain date, and that that date should therefore be the break date. And the courts have been clear that specific evidence in respect of specific property is required. And that's likely to, evidence is likely to be key in circumstances where the landlord isn't prepared to agree to the inclusion of a break clause.
So that's interesting. So you said that tenants will need to demonstrate that they will not need the premises. It's quite common for NHS trusts to be occupying for the purpose of a clinical services contract, which may or may not be renewed at the end of its term. Is may not be required sufficient to satisfy the court, or is it a case that it has to be will not be required?
Yeah, so generally, I think the position would be that the court would probably require something closer to will rather than may. It might be prepared to accept or order that wording be included to say that in circumstances where a service contract is terminated, then the break can be operated
for those purposes,
because it's clear that the trust tenant won't require the property after the service contract has come to an end. So I think it's purely going to be a case of including a break clause in there, which might require the trust to provide evidence of termination of the service contract.
Okay, thank you. So, I mean, potentially that sounds quite challenging for NHS trusts who may end up in occupation of premises beyond the length of their service contract. Are there any situations in which the 1954 Act actually protects trusts?
Yes, there are. It's not all doom and gloom, definitely. It's not uncommon for a third-party occupier to find themselves informally occupying premises in the trust estate at a rent for a term. On the face of it, in those circumstances, they may satisfy the test for a 1954 Act protected tenancy. However, as you know, many health-related leases are granted at concessionary rents. So a tenant who's therefore seeking to extend its occupation beyond the contractual term would potentially have to pay market rent to remain in occupation if it wishes to argue it has protection under the 1954 Act. It can't generally have it both ways and say, I'm a 1954 Act protected tenant, but I wanted to continue to pay this concessionary rent. The Act doesn't really cater for those types of rent.
Excellent. Thank you very much, George. So do you have a final piece of advice for parties in approaching negotiation of the new provisions in a lease renewal?
Yeah, so I think the key is to dust off the current lease well in advance of any timescales for potential renewal proceedings, which I mentioned above, so that we can think carefully about the existing drafting and provisions and what they might or might not cover and cater for in the modern property market. And also, it allows you to identify what are the key must-haves for you in renewal negotiations. And in terms of discussions with the other side, it's often better to do that as early as possible. At the very least, it gives you an idea as to what items may be in dispute so that they can be considered in more detail. So, for instance, going back to the estate code issue, is a landlord going to accept a break after year five, or is that something that we're going to need to fight about?
George, that's been really interesting and helpful. Thank you very much. Thank you to everybody who's listening. And as always, please do get in touch if you'd like to discuss any of the matters raised by today's podcast. Thank you.